Springtime is upon us, and although we are still in lockdown, there's plenty of wonderful things to talk about on television. New works from Steve Martin, the wonderful Rose Leslie, Gabriel Byrne in the new series of War of the Worlds. We've got music from the 80s in Under the Volcano. We're going to get a bit sad and morose with Screen Watching Middleboot and talk about 9/11. And an interview with director James Ashcroft, whose new New Zealand film Coming Home in the Dark is keeping people awake at night all over the world. It is a very busy Screen Watching.
This is not like TV, only better.
Television! Teacher! Mother!
Secret lover.
What, that's it? That's your movie?
Well, I said that I had an idea for a movie.
Yes, it is a very busy Screen Watching this week. We have got plenty to talk about, and we should start talking about it straight away. Happy springtime to you, Mr. Dan Barrett.
It's springtime. The birds are singing. The bees are doing stuff. I think the birds and bees are having sex with each other or something. It's an exciting time to be around.
Yeah, that's exactly right. It is an exciting time to be around. A mixed bag in the review section this week. Lots of very sort of left field things to talk about. That's how we like it. Going to keep things light and fluffy, as we discussed previously.
Now, that said, sorry, Simon, I've actually got to interrupt the podcast here for a moment. I've got to make an apology from last week's show. Look, I'm embarrassed about this. I used some language in last week's show that I need to apologize for.
Yeah.
I was called out on it during the week. And look, I'm not happy that this language was used. I've never used this language before. I'm never planning to ever use this language ever again. In last week's podcast, people may have heard me use the phrase twice within minutes on the show, using the phrase day dot. Now, look, I'm not happy that I said this. And as I said, I'm never going to say this again, but I apologize wholeheartedly to people who had to experience that. I'd never use that phrase, and it's just not part of my character. But thank you, everyone, for being very gracious about it. And the person who pointed it out, they didn't want me to resign, which I had promised to do immediately when I found out this. But like, ultimately, I think it's a learning experience for us all.
I think it is. It's a strange phrase. I recall you saying it, and my stomach turned a little bit as well.
Twice, Simon. Twice I
twice.
Used it.
Offensive. Yeah. People got in touch with me and asked, what's wrong with Dan? And I said, this is about day dot, isn't it? And yeah, they did. That's exactly what happened. But, you know, he's turned it around, and that's what we appreciate, Dan, and thank you for. It makes you more of a man in our eyes.
I apologize wholeheartedly. I've brought shame upon both myself, my family, my friends, and to you, Simon. So I'd like to apologize on behalf of me and to the Screen Watching community. Anyway, Simon, let's get on with a whole bunch of reviews which have got ahead of us.
It stinks.
Simon, let's kick off reviews this week with a brand new movie in cinemas now. It's called Streamline.
This is the biggest mate of your life. I will not let you lose focus. You leave what's going on at home, at home.
I'm making the Olympic team this year.
Then what?
I'm an Olympian.
And all your problems go away?
Levi Miller, who we know from the Red Dog films as the young kid, he's grown into quite the strapping young man. He plays 15-year-old swimmer Benjamin Lane. He is an introvert who is starting to resent getting up at early hours of the morning to train for the qualifying events for the Olympic Games. His mental state, his disciplines are challenged when his father, played by Jason Isaacs, is released from prison. Right when he's at the peak of his physical fitness, he decides to turn his back on swimming. His mother, played by Laura Gordon, his screaming coach, played by Robert Morgan, and head to live with his very off-the-rails brothers, particularly Jake Ryan, who's a crazy individual in this film, who are working the cane fields out in outback Queensland. This film presents itself very much as a sort of a traditional sports drama, the champion swimmer who's sort of has obstacles put in front of him through his life, and then will he or won't he make the Olympic team. But what it sort of turns into is this rather tough story about a young boy who's suffering PTSD after the abuse as a child, and about trying to reconcile with everyone's ambitions for him. It's a lot smarter and a lot better than I thought it was going to be. It's only in fairly limited release around Australia. It goes into cinemas, wherever cinemas are open, this week, September 2, it started up. It will be available to stream on Stan from 16th of September, which is probably going to be the best place to see this film. Levi Miller, like I say, he is grown into a terrific young actor. This is the darkest he's ever been on screen, bringing all sorts of layers to the role of Benjamin, or Boyd Lane, as he's known in the film. And Jason Isaacs, who turns up for a few moments, not a lot. He plays a father looking for some kind of redemption after his time in the clink. This was a surprise. It went to sort of stronger, more potent places than I was expecting. So bravo to the Oz industry for turning out a small scale, but a bit of quality filmmaking.
Yeah, a really controversial thing I'm going to say right now. I really like Jason Isaacs.
Yeah, me too. So do I. And I don't know whether he's based in Australia, but he's done some Australian work of late. This is a very small film for someone of his sort of international stature to come down under for. But I think he worked with Levi in the Red Dog films, didn't he? So maybe they know each other. So but he's very good in it. And I can't sort of stress how good Jake Ryan is, this mean, big behemoth of a sort of alpha male brother, who sets Ben on a strange path, a destructive path. So, quality acting all around.
Simon, this was going to be my TV event of the year. Did it live up to my self-imposed hype? Let's find out. It's only Murders in a Building.
Approximately 12 minutes from now, I will be murdered.
Tim Kono's death has been ruled a homicide, and apparently one of you jerk-offs did it.
I can't stop thinking about this.
Neither can I.
We should do our own true crime podcast.
We're going to go down there and look around for clues. Do you want to come?
Do I want to break into a dead guy's apartment and go through all his shit? Sounds like an afternoon.
Steve Martin and Martin Shaw are in a new TV series together. That's it. That's the review. Simon?
I'm good with that. That's fine with me. You go ahead.
Let's go a little bit deeper. Okay, so the Martins, Steve and Shaw, and Selena Gomez, they live in a fancy New York City apartment building. There's a murder in a building that brings them together. The three of them, who don't really know each other previously other than polite nods in a hallway, they come together, they discover they've got a shared interest in true crime podcasts, and they band together to produce their own true crime podcast series exploring the murder of their deceased neighbor. But that's not the only mystery at play. All three of our protagonists also have their own secrets they're hiding from the world. Martin Short's a Broadway producer who's fallen on hard times and has some serious money problems. Selena Gomez is a childhood friend of the victim and has her own secrets to be told. And Steve Martin's character is a guarded former TV star from an 80s detective cop show who's also got his own secrets to reveal. First and foremost, this is a fun cast. The casting of Gomez does feel a little bit off due to the generational difference and the strong bind that we've got with Steve Martin and Martin Short having together, as well as our connection with them as viewers, but that actually works to the strength of the series by making it feel slightly off-kilter. Now, screen-watching Jewish patron saint Jackie Hoffman, she makes a few appearances in early episodes of the show, and you will find a slew of well-known faces in various episodes. Watch for a well-known guest star in the first episode as the narrator of the serial-esque podcast that they love listening to. Now the show, it'll feel familiar to anyone who's seen Steve Martin's movies where he's got a major role in a creative of them. That is to say that the jokes are all smart, self-deprecating, and also slightly surreal at times. This is a fun, warm blanket show, and I had a great time with the first few episodes. I'm looking forward to dipping in and out of this world each week for the next month and a half. Did it live up to the hype? I'm smitten.
Me too. Yep, I'm three episodes in, and I actually think that the casting of Selena Gomez opposite these two is a bit of a masterstroke. It is totally out of left field, but she has some of the funniest lines in the series to date. When they referred to one character as Ursula and she said the sea witch, I must admit I broke out laughing at length. That was a very funny line. Look, it is surreal when it needs to be. It dips in and out of the characters' personal lives and backstory with a real master's touch. And it's a beautiful looking series as well. This has got sort of classic New York television written all over it. So, yes, I'm on board. Don't expect big sort of three amigos like Guffaws. It's not that sort of Steve Martin short film project, but it is a TV show that shows the class involved, and that all comes through. So yeah, big fan.
Yeah, it's definitely more in line with Steve Martin's things that he's really been involved with himself in terms of the creative. So it's not just things that he was an actor in. So while Three Amigos was him just being sort of a bit of a goofy guy, it's not that wasn't really a Steve Martin joint. In the same way, this is more like, say, L.A. Story, for example, or Bowfinger, or maybe Shop Girl to an extent.
Yeah.
Simon, we've got a music festival. Where are we going?
Yes, we have a new musical documentary called Summer of Soul, or When the Revolution Could Not Be Televised.
I was nervous. I didn't expect a crowd like that. Something very important was happening. It wasn't just about the music.
1969 was a change of era in the black community.
The styles were changing.
Music was changing.
And revolution was coming together.
We are a new people.
Just down the road from Woodstock in the summer of 1969, and by just down the road I mean a bit over 100 miles, the Harlem Cultural Festival was taking place in Mount Morris Park in New York City. This whole event was an extraordinary celebration of black music, black history, and what Summer of Soul, or When the Revolution Could Not Be Televised, does is capture this moment in time with footage that has never been seen. This was largely forgotten until now. A lot of this footage has never been released. So what you get is, at the very height of their musical power, performers like Stevie Wonder and Nina Simone, Gladys Knight and the Pips, Mahalia Jackson, B.B. King, all performing for a predominantly black crowd at the height of the Summer of Love. It's an extraordinary documentary that really sort of places the significance of music and culture to the African-American community in the late 60s in New York, and how that extends right up until today, and what a potent and powerful statement it is. There's not a lot to review here. You've just got to say that the footage is extraordinarily well restored. The sound quality is superb, so you hear the music in all its glory. And while we've all celebrated, and in recent months sort of tore shreds off the Woodstock Festival, I think Summer of Soul and the celebration of the Harlem Cultural Festival is every bit as important, and this documentary points that out quite clearly. It's called Summer of Soul, or When the Revolution Could Not Be Televised.
Now, I tried watching this like maybe about a month ago, and when I was doing it, I was in the process of building a cupboard that I'd bought from IKEA. And I was just getting frustrated with Allen keys and dowels and stuff. And so I realized midway through that I just wasn't really giving it the due attention, because from what I was seeing of it, it was so good. But because I wasn't actively watching it, I wasn't seeing some of the footage I'd never seen before. And I felt I was really just not doing a due service. So I want to get back to this one, because like from what I saw, it knocked me out. I just wasn't giving it the attention it deserves.
You really should. It apart from the extraordinary music that comes through in the concert footage, the spirituality of people like Mahalia Jackson and Jesse Jackson sort of up there on stage doing what they do and sort of enrapturing the crowd in the gospel and in the the spirituality of the event is absolutely extraordinary. Not overly politicized. It's really more a celebratory film than a one that speaks to any hardcore truths or injustices, but just in presenting these bands and these people and the time, that's all implied. So, it's a terrific film. Summer of Soul is in limited release in cinemas now and on a few of the streaming platforms if you can get them.
Simon, I want to talk to you about a new exciting property called War of the Worlds.
Is it like this everywhere?
How would you know, man? There's no phone, no internet.
You have somewhere to go?
I have to find my family.
We're looking for our son.
Some people made it out.
We'll find him, Ella.
Help me, please.
Debuting its second season this month is War of the Worlds. The show hasn't gotten a lot of buzz, so it seemed like a good time to point out you're likely missing out on a pretty good show. By this stage, we've all seen countless remakes and adaptations of War of the Worlds. Is there really anything at all left to say at this stage? The story's been told in movies and TV shows and comics and radio serials and the original book. Repeatedly, we've seen it, it's done. Heck, season one of the series debuted just a few months after the BBC released its own period-era three-part miniseries version of War of the Worlds, so we are not in a shortage of War of the Worlds content by any means. This new version stars Gabriel Byrne amongst an ensemble cast of humans who are left wondering what the heck's going on around them after aliens attack the Earth. They don't make contact, they just attack. Where this new show has value is that the show isn't being told from the perspective of the country it's being made from. This isn't like every other alien invasion thing from the US where, you know, the world's at stake but we only ever hear from the Americans. Instead, this is more of a European affair, with Brits, Irish, French and other characters all being impacted by the alien attack. The show also takes a more modern approach to the concept. Instead of the humans being attacked by tripod alien vehicles, the advanced troops are instead robot dogs that are not all that dissimilar to those that we've seen from Boston Dynamics. Now, you already know War of the Worlds, there's no reason to explain it much further. Just know there's a fantastic ensemble. As I mentioned, Gabriel Byrne's the biggest name in there, but there's also beloved and familiar faces like Daisy Edgar-Jones, Elizabeth McGovern, and Leah Drucker in the series. The tension's taut, the special effects are impressive, and the characters are engaging to hang around with as they navigate their way through a new normal. This is good trash TV.
Yeah, all reports are good on this. As a sci-fi fan, I'm not quite sure why this has slipped me by. Maybe because I'd seen this version or a version of this story so many times before, but everyone I turn to says that it's definitely worth a look, so I'm going to binge season one then get around to season two. Let's go from the summer of 1969 in Harlem to the early 80s in Montserrat with the other documentary we're looking at this week, Under the Volcano.
It was a glorious dream that George Martin had.
A fantastic state-of-the-art studio in the Caribbean.
It was so successful. It was a hit factory.
He's recognized as the greatest record producer the industry has yet seen, George Martin.
George's idea was to take people out of an environment, to put them into harmony with nature.
Going to Montserrat was like going into a dream.
It was great to have an environment around us where you could escape to.
Australian director Gracie Otto gathers together some of the musical stars of my youth for the documentary Under the Volcano. This is a very intimate look at the story of George Martin's Air Studios on the island of Montserrat in the Caribbean. And the people, both the superstar talent and the people of the villages of Montserrat who made all that happen. This was the studio that was set up in the shadow of an active volcano in some of the most beautiful Caribbean landscapes that you can imagine. People from all around the world, artists like Sir Paul McCartney, The Police, The Rolling Stones, Ultravox, Duran Duran, all came there to record some of the most iconic albums of the 1980s. And this documentary uses archival footage of these bands and these artists recording their songs and their albums, as well as interviews with current interviews with those that were there in the time. In this regard, it's an absolute celebration of 80s pop music. You get to see Dire Straits recording their Money for Nothing album, Midge and the Ultravox team there. All of the Police's most famous songs were recorded on the island. In fact, the famous Don't Stand So Close to Me film clip was just the band and a couple of other guys grabbing a camera and heading down into the village and dancing with all the locals. And Martin himself, who's this very prim and proper English gentleman, is sort of revealed to be just an absolute master of music recording. When the island was destroyed, first by Hurricane Hugo in 1989, and then in 1995 when the volcano erupted, the dream of Air Studios was destroyed. The road to Air Studios is cut off now by lava flow, and is the whole sort of studio setup now is completely barren. But the memories that this fantastic documentary brings back are just wonderful. So Under the Volcano, available for digital download on all the digital platforms, is absolutely worth seeing.
Yeah, I've heard really good things elsewhere as well, so definitely going to give this one a gander. Simon, let's wind out the week this week with a conversation about Vigil.
Casualty, casualty, casualty.
This is DCI Amy Silver.
Earlier today, crewman died on board Vigil.
How are you with confined spaces?
I'm gonna need someone who can radio me leads. I've got a good shorthand with Kirsten. I think this was a murder.
That's absurd.
If you're asking who's capable, anybody.
This is a six-part BBC drama series. It's about a British Navy submarine that goes into the water. There's a trawler that's above. It's a Scottish trawler. It gets caught by the submarine and dragged underneath, which ends up killing all the fishermen on it. There's one of the guys on the thing, one of the guys that looks at the beeps, the bleeps, and the bloops, and he says, there's something out there, and nobody's really taking him that seriously, and he's essentially identified the fact that I've picked up this trawler and, you know, been responsible for these guys' death. If they'd listened to him straight away, these guys might have lived. They didn't. Anyway, this guy shortly afterwards gets a little bit murdered. So what takes place then is a murder investigation into what happened on board the boat, because a submarine's called a boat and not a ship. That's an important bit of information I learned from this program. Now, you've got a pair of investigators who are trying to get to the top, get a handle as to what happened here. One of them's on the submarine itself. The other one is on top of the water talking to people out in the land lobbers. And so the mystery's been set. Over the next six episodes, we're going to find out what took place. Now, Simon, you'd seen this before I got around to it. You quite liked it. I found this such a dull chore to get through.
Oh my goodness.
I know. And I knew you were going to have an issue with me saying that. I think all the pieces are in place for it to be kind of interesting, but it's not six episodes worth of interesting, and I've only gotten through the first episode, and I've got no interest at all in returning to this. It just kind of felt like there was not enough in one episode to really keep me that engaged. How's it going to sustain itself over six episodes? And I'm just not there prepared to find out.
It is, I will say that it is a cracking first episode. I thought it set up all the twists and turns of the plot moving forward that it needed to. Your two key investigators, they've got their own very complex backstory. The dynamic of the men and some women aboard the boat or the submarine, I thought was fantastic. The actual effects work, the opening where the trawler is sunk is just some pretty grueling to watch. I thought it was really potent and powerful stuff.
See, this is the thing. You found that potent and powerful. I was just looking at it thinking, these are terrible special effects. And it just sort of seemed as though all the actors were acting against blue screens. And it just didn't really feel like it was authentic at all. There seems to be no effort made at all to try to hide some of the sort of low-grade special effects that were in place here.
All right. We'll row different boats on this one, you and I, Mr. Barrett. It's called Vigil. It is across all the Foxtel channels. This is the screen watching middle bit, which is getting a wonderful response from the fans. Thank you for all your feedback. The week ahead sees the 20th anniversary of a defining moment of our lifetime, the 9/11 attacks on the World Trade Center. We thought it would be interesting to look back at not specifically how those attacks impacted us, but how television played a role in bringing those moments into our lives. I have a very vivid memory of it. In 2001, I was a young father. My youngest daughter was still a toddler. So my eldest daughter was still a toddler, I should say. And this sort of seismic change in modern history was brought to my living room by the television coverage. Kick off, Dan Barrett. What do you recall? How old were you when it happened? And what do you recall about how these events unfolded?
So to my memory, I was watching an episode of The West Wing, or at least I was waiting for The West Wing to start when this started all sort of going down. So I was there watching it was the end of season two, which is quite a dramatic period of The West Wing. It may even have been the series season finale. So I was watching sort of this fictional US political world with some real world events taking place at the same time, and it just kind of converged in my mind a little bit. But the thing that probably really resonated with me was that I was in first, second year uni, third year, something like that. But I remember I had an exam. Well, was it an exam? Yeah, it was an exam the next morning. Basically, I'd stayed up all night watching CNN coverage coming through and neglected to study for this exam, bombed out terribly the next day, and as did the majority of people. Like, when they end up announcing sort of how poorly everyone did with that exam, basically it just kind of like wiped everyone out. So what I'm saying is, we were the real victims that day.
Of course, yes, of course you were. Okay, so that fits with what's become a bit of an urban myth, but what you say sort of makes it true. The September 11 attacks took place at 8:45 a.m. on Tuesday morning in New York City, which was 10:45 p.m. Tuesday evening. Now, that was when the first plane hit. So when the second plane hit 18 minutes later, coverage had begun. Now, I recall at the time that many people thought it was an element of the West Wing. Some people thought that it had been sort of integrated into the narrative of the West of the, that episode of the West Wing.
That comes surely from people falling asleep on the couch watching TV and they're slowly coming to.
And perhaps, yes. Now, I should point out that I was not watching television when the second plane hit, so I missed that sort of defining moment. But because I had a toddler who was up through the night, I did catch up with the telecast through the evening when we were getting up to feed or change the bub. Then I was seeing it on television, dipping in and out of sleep, but certainly watching as it unfolded. It really became a vast television event the next day when I sat in front of the television the whole day, getting stories of the feedback, getting the changing death toll, which topped out at just shy of 2,996 people were killed, including citizens from 78 countries who died in the four plane crashes. So for me, it was this sort of unfolding wave of horror and terror and sadness. I should point out, I was at the World Trade Centers in 1995. I was very familiar with the landscape and the setting and the immensity of these buildings. So when this started to happen, it's ridiculous to suggest I felt any kind of real connection to the horror, but being familiar with the buildings, the lift wells, the foyer, the underground shopping malls, all those sort of places, it did sort of bring a slightly sort of surreal aspect to it for me. And it was an extraordinary moment in our lives. Do you recall much of how Australian television kept track of the events? I think I think most of the channels switched to 24-hour news cycles for the next 48 hours at least.
No, that's it. Like, I just remember it was just constant coverage from that point in, as you'd expect. Like, it was it really did shift the world dramatically since then. Like, I think all the TV focus on at the time was required. I do recall the next day, because as I said, like, I was at uni and I had that exam the next day. I do remember after that exam sitting in a food court in a Myer Centre in Brisbane, and there's always like large TV screens up in those kind of environments, and like there was just that constant coverage on in the background. And for the next few weeks, just walking around and like buildings, just living my life, I'd always just sort of see the coverage happening sort of just wherever I was at. It was just relentless. But I guess maybe when I think about this, I do start thinking about the way that TV coverage just sort of immediately sort of shifts on a dime anytime big events like this take place. So September 11th is the one that we're obviously talking about right now. But I do remember being a kid when the Gulf War started, like watching, and that's a milestone in terms of TV news coverage. So up until the Gulf War, like when news was happening, it often just happened and you would see the wrap of it on the news. There might be a special bulletin or something, but it was never this 24/7 rolling coverage. But that began with the Gulf War, and I just remember watching presumably some cartoons. I know it was Channel 7 on a Saturday morning. I don't remember exactly what I was watching. But I do remember the coverage sort of clicked over, and as a young viewer, I was just like entranced by this entirely new type of TV coverage. I hadn't really seen TV like that before, and it was, you know, obviously changed us all, obviously for the best. Like, I think we're all better for 24/7 rolling news coverage, are we not, Simon?
Oh, yeah, sure. We're all very grateful for that. So to celebrate to acknowledge, I should say, the 20th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks, there are some significant documentaries being released over the next little while. Already on the Apple Plus platform, you can see 9/11 Inside the President's War Room, which speaks to President Bush and all his flunkies who had to deal with it at the time. On the Fox Docos channel, you can see New York City Epicenters 9/11 to 2021 and a half. That's the Spike Lee mega documentary that looks at how the 9/11 attacks impacted his city of New York.
The controversial Spike Lee series.
Yeah, it's copped a bit of flack and actually went back into the editing room to remove some conspiracy nuts from the...
So I think it's episode 5 of the series was some truthers that were being interviewed with very little pushback within the program. Mm-hmm. Anyway, some critics saw it and said, what the hell is this? And there was a bit of a minor kerfuffle, which caused Spike Lee to go back in there and re-edit it. So apparently that's all been excised from the documentary, but even so, it's definitely left a bad taste in some people's mouths.
And if you do get an opportunity, there is a landmark documentary just called 9/11 in which three filmmakers, James Hanlon and two Frenchmen, Jules and Gideon Nibou, I think it's pronounced, they were filming a documentary in New York City about a rookie firefighter on the very day that 9/11 happened. And this first-person account of the unfolding of the World Trade Center attacks is just one of the most gut-wrenching and heartbreaking documentaries you'll ever see. It won a couple of Emmys, I think, for its presentation of the event, and obviously has some very moving moments when it talks about the lives of the firefighters, those who survived and those who didn't on 9/11. During the week, I spoke to director James Ashcroft. His film Coming Home in the Dark is a chilling psychological thriller that tells the story of a young family taken hostage by two killers on the remote highways of New Zealand. It stars favourite TV dad Eric Thompson in a very different role and a terrifying Daniel Gillies as one of the killers. It's the feature debut of director James Ashcroft, a hugely respected theatre director in his homeland, and now on the back of the response to his film after its Sundance premiere, one of the hottest new Hollywood properties already in theatres across the ditch and out next week here in Australia on September 9. Here's my chat with the very talented James Ashcroft.
Let's some of the film's coverage so far, you know, it cites films like Wolf Creek and the Rutger Hauer classic, The Hitcher, in its use of open roads and remote locations. But, you know, no spoilers, but a big chunk of that is kind of played out in Act One. It's like you and Eli Kent, the writer, sort of recognized the genre template, then tossed it away. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I mean, you know, we grew up on films like The Hitcher and a lot of those road movies, and that's very much a part of the story. But, you know, it's one of those stories, even Owen Marshall's short story that the work's inspired by is one that it starts out as one thing and then it becomes something else. So it's quite a surprising film in that respect. And I like that it sort of subverts some of those, you know, conventions that are associated with those road trip thrillers.
How much of Owen's story is in there? You allude to it sort of taking bits of it. And yeah. I know from some other research I've done that Owen's story kind of ended and has had a less developed Eric Thompson character in that one. How much sort of made it to the screen?
Yeah, I mean, look, the premise of Owen's and the intention of Owen's, original short story is absolutely there. I would say, to be honest, it's the first 20 minutes of the film is, you know, pretty much beat for beat the short story as it stands. Ultimately, the short story sort of ends there, and it's a short story about violence, the random acts of violence that happen on our landscape. And you know, we remain true to that intention to an extent. But there was a big question for us when I optioned the short story of how do we get underneath that very potent kernel of an idea to have it speak to something more personal and contemporary to audiences to engage with. And that's where we brought in that element of, you know, the long shadow of state-run institutions and the effects that, you know, that are still being felt today.
Your leading man, Eric Thompson, certainly embracing his everyman kind of dad bod and challenging fans of his, you know, favourite TV father persona. What does an experienced presence like Eric's add to a tough physical shoot like Coming Home in the Dark and a sort of challenging material as well?
Yeah, look, Eric was a real sport. I mean, you know, this is my first feature. Eric's a very well-known actor, you know, both here and And in Australia, he's the mutual middle-class father, good man figure for both countries, I think. So, and that's why I wanted to cast Eric in that role. And I think ultimately, too, that's why Eric wanted to play this role, because it was sort of, you know, subverting aspects of that characterization that he's so used to. You know, normally he's filming on a beach or in a very comfortable home. So this was slightly different for him. And, it was a really tough shoot. It was 20 days on location at night in the middle of winter here. That discomfort that you see on screen is palpable because it's real.
Yeah.
It's what the actors were going with. We're all rugged up, of course, and they're running around with, you know, whatever their day clothes were. But he brings that wonderful, earthy, grounded, relatable, you know, value to his characters and his characterization. But and he just gave me a lot of confidence, you know, and really, really helped hold that on the set as well as, you know, a well-known actor.
You lean into, well, I guess I'm fascinated by the grey areas you work with Mandrake, the brilliant Daniel Gillies. He commits this terrible act, this brutal act, sort of 5 minutes after you introduce him, and then we spend the film sort of getting inside his head, and I'm thinking you're performing this balancing act with the audience, reconciling his motivations, which we kind of agree with, and his actions, which we clearly don't agree with. So it is a complex killer in the way that, you know, the John Jarrett in Wolf Creek or other sort of genre tropish kind of road killers aren't.
Yeah, I mean, I don't really see the world in black and white terms. I'm very much drawn to stories and characters that, sit in that gray space. And I think one of the things that Eli and I are very much drawn to is that question of the grey in characters, grey characters, whether you agree with them or not, whether their actions are, reprehensible, or they need to have their comeuppance, or balance needs to be restored is by the by. I think, you know, rich characters are the grey ones. And in this case, you know, all these characters sort of, you know, they dance on that sort of tightrope between good and bad. Because I think if you black and white any of these characters, then we're able to put them at a distance. We're able to sort of go easily, you know, that's not me. That's not somebody I know. With this, you know, there's a level of accountability we're wanting to, you know, look at and discuss and open up a conversation about with this film. And that requires an audience to sort of, you know, make decisions for themselves. And by presenting, you know, obviously a character who's does some pretty reprehensible things like Mandrake, as well as Tubbs, it's interesting to start the film feeling a certain way about them and then feeling slightly compromised and questioning your thoughts about them at the end. And the same with the other characters in the film, specifically Hoagie.
The hot button issue of systemic abuse is one of the hot button issues in you deal with these characters. The other, and I'm keen to delve into this with you, is the race issue, the Maori Pākehā mix in both the family and the killers. What role did you see race playing in your narrative?
Well, look, I mean, to be frank, going into it, we had a variety of people that we were looking at for these roles. I was adamant that if we were going to cast a Maori actor in any role, it was going to be as the mother, as Jill, as the matriarch of the family, someone who's strong, committed, thinks smart, reacts well, and has, you know, a lot of skin in the game considering what she goes through. And why I was adamant that we were going to cast a Māori actor in that role was because those are the types of roles that Māori female actors never get cast in. And I really wanted to, you know, go against that sort of stereotype. From there, and I mean, and that said, once Miriama McDowell auditions for you, you know, it's a no-brainer. Miriama's one of our best actors, irregardless of race and culture. With with Mandrake and Tubbs, you know, I always had a feeling it was going to be a case of wanting to represent both Pākehā and or Māori Pacifica. And important to note that Matthias Luafutu, who plays Tubbs, is Samoan. He's not Māori.
Okay.
And I think that's important to have a mix there, because ultimately what we're talking about with their characters is, yes, you can look to the facts of what institutions that were state-run. Obviously, from the 70s onwards, the residency is predominantly Māori, is predominantly Pacifica. But ultimately, what we're looking at is how children were failed. And for me, you know, it's really important to go, I'm not looking at children by demographic. I'm looking at all of those, you know, the 100,000 children who went through those institutions and were failed by them. Mm. So that's probably, you know, why it wasn't. I knew it was going to go in a mixed marriage of sorts on both pairs, but also, you know, I'm not making a statement. It's there. I know I have my reasons why we did it, like I've said, but equally that could have played out in another roundabout way with those characters in particular. So there's no denying that, you know, state-run institutions and the abuse that, you know, and the failings that they've had on countries like New Zealand, like Australia, you know, that there is a strong aspect of colonisation to the implementation of those places and such. So, like I say, I always knew it was going to be part of that. But ultimately, too, you don't want to discount what the actor, the right tool for the right job, and what the actor brings. Matthias Luafutu was somebody I pretty much always had in the back of my head for the role of Tubbs. You know, it was just sort of sitting there when we started writing it. And that's because probably, I went to drama school with Matthias. I know what his strengths are. I know what a huge talent he is. And also I know how to work with him. And, you know, if anything, I think, you know, he brings, you know, the most emotional and grounded performance to the work. And he doesn't say that. He says that in three lines, I think.
Yeah, no, he's extraordinary. The casting across the board is one of the many assets of the film. I also want to ask about the language and the use of violence. What are your views on how genre cinema uses violence in modern filmmaking? And is Coming Home in the Dark, I guess, a more elevated horror work for its undercutting of violence as a central component in the story? Because you show arguably the most heinous act in those first opening minutes. It's like what Spielberg did with Jaws. Once you open it with the worst it can be, and then your whole movie has this undercurrent of tension and horror about it.
Yeah. Look, I think in terms of violence, I think it depends on what your film is. I mean, you know, there's violence that can be enjoyable. You know, Tarantino's made a huge living in great entertainment from the way he uses violence for humor, for drama, for shock. With this film in particular, you know, because it is a film that, you know, is a hard ask, but it was never our intention to make violence something that was going to be easy. We didn't want to make it palatable. If you actually watch the film back, you'll actually see that there's very little violence actually committed on screen. So, you know, trying to have a sense of responsibility as a filmmaker, I'm always going for, well, how do we engage emotion that's about feeling something rather than just something that's exploitive or shocking for shocking's sake? And there's no greater violence than exists in the audience's imagination. Mm. So that's why we sort of choreographed the violence to unfold and happen in that way, so it would sit within your psyche, within your consciousness, and therefore would make more of an impact. And again, it's about, you know, how is it relevant to the material? We're using violence to speak about something rather than rather than as an entertaining factor.
Simon, we'd like to wind out the podcast each week with a look at the week ahead. Now, this week coming is a little bit interesting. So as of today, so we're recording this on Friday, and unfortunately the podcast will probably go out Saturday morning because I'm a bit jam-packed today to get the edit out. But we've got the return of a few beloved shows today. So we've got AP Bio returning for season 4, Grantchester, which is a UK series that's back for season 6 as of today. But then there's a couple of other things. Silent Witness is back for season 24. You've got American Crime Story Impeachment, which is the season looking at the Lewinsky-Clinton affair. So that'll be an interesting one to take a gander at. And we'll be reviewing that on the podcast next week. There's also the season return of Lucifer. So that's season 6 kicking back. And that will be on, I think, Thursday or Friday next week. So there's a few beloved shows coming back. Nothing really in a way of new series that's really worth pointing out. So, you know, beloved favorites. And I think it's just exciting to see a few of those back.
And of all the movies debuting on streaming this week, probably the highest profile for all the wrong reasons is the Amazon Prime debut of Sony Pictures' Cinderella. This was a theatrical release that has been sent straight to Amazon Prime. That's not in itself a bad thing. The trailer looks quite good for this, and I'm keen to have a look. You know, I love my musicals. You also know that I hate James Corden, and I don't hate James Corden any more than I hate him this week for that stupid stunt he pulled on the streets of Los Angeles, where him and a few cast members decided to dance amongst traffic, dressed in Cinderella-type costumes, certainly not the expensive ones they use in the series, more sort of stupid ones you get from an op shop. And it was a piece of video that went all around the world and captured some really scathing remarks via the Twitter for James Corden stopping traffic at a point when a lot of people were trying to get back to work. So stupid James Corden, but I'm keen to see Cinderella. It looks cute.
What I'm really excited by is certainly not this movie and certainly not James Corden, because honestly, everything new about this kind of makes me feel a bit sick in my stomach. But I'm just excited by the fact that the world seems to have turned on James Corden. I've kind of felt like I've been an island for the last 5 to 10 years and nobody seems to want to come over and join me. But all of a sudden, I'm looking around on Dan Barrett's James Corden hating island. And look, it's populous. People are there playing beach games. There's lots of volleyball taking place. Like, there's a lot of folk who suddenly join me over here. And I'm very excited to see that. And just letting people know, I do have a bit of real estate over here for Josh Gad Island as well. So if people want to join me over here, like, you know, there's a lot of space. Just come on board quite early. I think people will get a lot out of it.
I'm not anti-Josh Gad. I'm sort of ambivalent about Josh Gad. I don't really care for anything about him.
You'll come over.
I'll come there eventually, don't worry. But James Corden, I don't know how he's positioned himself as this must-have presence in anything musical in the US. I was watching the trailer for Cinderella, and I'm going, oh, this looks nice, that's cute, oh, that's clever, oh, she's in it, oh, Minnie Driver, that's good. And then Mr. Corden pops up, and I just felt my whole mood sink instantaneously. And I thought, oh, not another James Corden musical. But, you know, I'll close my eyes when he's on screen because I am looking forward to seeing it. But yeah, I don't get it. I don't get what the James Corden thing is. And I can't. And you're absolutely not alone. I don't know anyone who thinks anything's ever been made better by putting James Corden in it. So suck it, James Corden.
Look, people loved him, and I would get nothing but scorn with my anti-Corden viewpoints. But as I said, people are coming on board this week. Apparently all it required was James Corden being seen dressed in a giant mouse costume, thrusting his hips at the camera.
That was terrible. Kids, if you haven't seen it, go and have a look at it, because it's extraordinary. And some of the commentary, one of the best ones I saw on Twitter was, "Hi, boss, sorry I'm late to work, but James Corden was thrusting his groin at me in the traffic today."
I can't talk about this anymore. I feel so unwell.
It's terrible. We should point out that around the country as we speak, in population centres where cinemas are open, a big new Marvel movie has been released, Shang-Chi and the Legend of the Ten Rings. Reviews have been very good for it. Simu Liu stars as Shang-Chi. He must confront the past he thought he left behind when he's drawn into a web of the mysterious Ten Rings organization. That's the Ten Rings of the title, you might have guessed. Stars the great Tony Leung. Also in there is the very funny Awkwafina, and Michelle Yeoh, the legendary Michelle Yeoh as well. So we'd have reviewed this if we'd had a chance to, but it's a direct-to-cinema MCU Disney release. They didn't put it on their streaming platform, unlike the last couple of releases. So we've missed out, but we've heard good things about this, right?
Look, I just think it's exciting that finally cinema gets a kung fu movie.
Yes, it is necessary to keep the whole business afloat.
It's been such a long time coming.
Yeah, it's going to be a while until we get to see Shang-Chi, which is a shame. Also in cinemas is Eiffel. This is the true story of Gustave Eiffel and how he managed to build this big tower in the middle of Paris. Classic cinema. Well done. You pointed out some special event cinema at GOMA.
At GOMA, which is the Gallery of Modern Arts cinema, their Cinematheque, they've got Ghost Stories, Spirits, Hauntings and World Beyonds, which is a program they're running from September 10. They've got some 4K restorations of films including The Shining and The Fog. They've got a 35mm presentation of Beetlejuice, which I rewatched the other day on Netflix. My God, that film makes me laugh.
That's one of my favourite all-time movies. Don't watch that any day of the week.
Incredible. Also getting 35mm treatment there is The Haunting and Candyman, which I will follow through with another four times I'm going to say it. Candyman, 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 Candyman.
Don't do it! What are you doing? Asking for trouble.
Really am.
And at the Darwin Deck Chair Cinema, boy, they're dragging out one of the old classics now. They're presenting Blazing Saddles on Sunday, September 5 from 7 p.m. Good on you, Darwin Deck Chair. There's been a lot of, they wouldn't get away with making that nowadays talk about Blazing Saddles. And you're right, they wouldn't. But it's still a very, very funny movie.
Yo, where those white women at? Hey, let's take a look at This Week in History. Now, the exciting thing about a This Week in History segment when we're doing it through September is for the next 4 weeks, we're guaranteed to have some very big notable anniversaries because the American TV season traditionally kicked off in September. So we can point out that September 5, 1976, The Muppet Show premiered with Mia Farrow as the guest on that episode. We've got the debut of ESPN on September 7, 1979. One of the all-time goats of television, Star Trek, it debuted on September 8, 1966 with one William Shatner and Leonard Nimoy. What else we got here? We've got Elvis Presley making his first appearance on The Ed Sullivan Show on September 9, 1956. But cut to September 10, 1993, a anniversary very dear to my heart. The X-Files with David Duchovny and one Gillian Anderson. It debuted on a network, a struggling little network called Fox.
And in the birthdays coming up in the week ahead, September 5, the great Bob Newhart was born in Oak Park, Illinois, one of the funniest men ever to step in front of a camera. The very beautiful Raquel Welch was born September 5, 1940 in Chicago, Illinois. Illinois, shout out today. September 9, 1980, Michelle Williams from Dawson's Creek was born in Kalispell, Montana. And this one's just for me, my childhood crush, my first teen dream queen, the lovely Christy McNichol, star of Family and Emptiness. She was born on September 11, 1962 in LA, California.
Now, just because we mentioned Star Trek being 1966 and the anniversary, can I just point out 1966 is this amazing year for US TV. Can I point out some of the things that debuted that year, which doing some rough math in my head now makes it, how many years? 55-year anniversary this year. Yeah. Okay, so debuting in 1966, you've got, and I'm going through a Wikipedia article here, so I apologize if I'm missing anything. You've got the 1960s Batman TV show debuting in January. You've got Till Death Do Us Part on the BBC. You've got Dark Shadows debuting that year. Wow. You've got perennial game show classic, The Newlywed Game, kicking off. Ultraman, the big Japanese superhero getting in fights with monsters in costumes and lots of rubber, that debuted in July of 1966. You got the Australian version of Play School that kicked off.
Wow.
Yeah, you've got Star Trek. You've got That Girl. You've got the TV series of Tarzan. You've got the Green Hornet. You've got the Time Tunnel. You've got the Monkees. You've got the Girl from Uncle. You've got Mission Impossible debuting that year. Like, that's a heck of a lot.
That is an extraordinary lineup. I can't think of anything else. I mean, probably at the height of the 70s television boom that might have had a similar year, but that's amazing for 1966. How about that?
Yeah, and it's not like these are just continuing shows that happen to be on in 1966. They all just debuted that year. It's kind of incredible.
We should track that. We'll be careful to make sure we mention all of 1966's great shows.
Indeed. Simon, are we close to wrapping this thing up?
I really hope so. It's been kind of a crazy morning.
Okay, let's wind it out. So thank you very much for listening to Screen Watching. I'm Dan Barrett. You can find me on Twitter at the Dan Barrett. You can start your day from day dot with my free newsletter. It's Always Be Watching. And that's at alwaysbewatching.com. It's got the big stories in TV, streaming and film. And on Fridays, you've got the Always Be Streaming newsletter, which recounts the big shows that launched that week.
My name is Simon Foster. I'm on the Twitter at SimonRFoster1. You can read my words over at screen-space.net. Do visit the Screen Watching Facebook page. We put a lot of new and fresh information up there. Go to the Screen Watching YouTube channel where you can see our uncut interview with James Ashcroft. You can also see an interview with the great Neil Blomkamp, director of District 9, and talking about his new film, Demonic. Go and check out the Sydney Science Fiction Film Festival page. That's my little festival, which we've got some big news to announce in the days ahead.
Excellent. And people should follow Screen Watching via your favorite podcast app. If you load it up now, hit the follow button, you'll be subscribed to the show, and you know, the goodness will just flow on in. This has been Screen Watching. My name's been Dan Barrett, will continue to be. Simon Foster, it's been an absolute pleasure.
No, it hasn't. It's been a trial. There's a whole lot of bloopers this morning that are going to make for a great Christmas reel, but let's see how it all sounds in the wash up. Thanks, Dan.
See you, Simon.